Well, my next guest can be hard to pin down at this time of year because he's bound to be found in the outdoors. Sean Barnett is an outdoors author, editor and photographer who began tramping as a teenager in the mountains of Hawke's Bay and has tramped the length and breadth of the country since. He's co-authored multiple award-winning books, among them Classic Tramping in New Zealand, Shelter from the Storm, the story of New Zealand's backcountry huts, and Tramping and New Zealand History. His latest work, though, it's the words of others he's brought to the fore. Across the Pass, a collection of New Zealand tramping writing, features the work of a range of Kiwi writers, from Sir Edmund Hillary and adventurer Graham Dingle to peace activist Elsie Locke and poet Sam Hunt. Sean joins us now on 9 to Noon, along with Wellington writer and tramping enthusiast Cathy Ombler, who shares her own tale of a cold night lost on Tongariro with a group of school children. Morena korua.
Morena.
Sean, kia ora, Susie.
Kia ora, thank you for being with us, both of you. Sean, if I can start with you. This particular book, you've been involved in a lot of books previously. So what does this one mean to you?
I think it's the book that I would have wanted to find when I was a 16-year-old just discovering the mountains. I struggled to find anything that reflected my own experiences of going into the Ruahine and Kaweka ranges. So instead I turned to hunting books. I just didn't know where to find writing about tramping. So I guess I've kind of made the book I would have wanted 35 years ago.
And so give us a sense of who you got to contribute to this book and how you went about doing that.
With my good friend and fellow historian Chris McLean, we did Tramping in New Zealand History, as you said before, and in that book we covered the development of tramping in New Zealand, and of course we quoted a lot of different trampers, but usually it was only one or two sentences or a paragraph there, and out of that project I really felt that we just needed a collection of writing where people could have their own voice, and we could have longer pieces. I think the longest is about 3,000 or 4,000 words. And there were a lot of obvious ones to come out. I'll mention Jeff Spearpoint and Mark Pickering, who have two pieces each, who are stalwarts of the tramping community and who have captured the experience very well in a number of books and articles. So I knew right from the get-go that those two would be in there. But I also wanted to include just as diverse a number of writers as possible, and diverse ways of expressing the experience too.
And there is quite a range of how people express themselves through this.
That's right. We've got poetry, we've got descriptive writing, we've got satire, and I've even got a lovely piece from Rosemary McLeod, the columnist who hates tramping. So I find that very entertaining, her take on it, because I think that's a valid perspective as well. It's not everyone's cup of tea.
Indeed. There's a fair bit of humour, I guess. There's also a fair bit of drama.
That's right, and I really wanted to capture that full range of experiences that you can have. There's a wonderful piece by an Otago writer called Calvin Lloyd, which talks about going on a university trip in the mountains near Makarora in Mount Aspiring National Park. And they have a little dog that they soon nicknamed Shrimpy that joins them on the trip for 4 days, and they can't make him go away. He keeps on coming with them, and he's an inveterate stick gatherer. They have to constantly throw sticks, and when they finally get up above the bush line, they have to throw rocks for him. And it turns out he was being looked after by people down the road, and he'd gone missing for 4 days. He just joined these trampers. So some quirky pieces like that in the book, as well as much more well-known pieces. I have some serious pieces of epics of exploration in New Zealand from Thomas Brunner on his great journey down the West Coast, where he faced starvation and had so many hardships that he actually had a stroke on that journey. So It does encapsulate a lot of different experiences and over a long period of time too.
Now, Kathy, if we can talk to you about the contribution that you have made to this. Lost on
Yes.
Tongariro, a group of school children, why did this one come to mind?
It was a very old story, something that happened back in the 1970s. And it actually, I came to write it mainly because of Sean as a mentor and a friend. He was encouraging me to put down some of my stories in writing. I do write articles about tramping and all sorts of wonderful things for various magazines. But when you're my age, you get a few experiences and adventures in your past. And I was recounting some of these to Sean. So he said, well, why don't you write them down? And so I did. So the Tongariro story was one of them that came to mind. My daughter had also be asked, asked had also asked me about what had happened. So I wrote it up and sent it off to Sean just as friends, saying, well, here's one of my stories. What do you think? And it was late in the day at the time of Sean putting his wonderful Across the Pass book together. And he had a late gap. He needed another story. So he asked me very kindly if I'd like to contribute it to the book, which was, of course, was a huge honour to be up there among some of those most interesting, famous writers in New Zealand.
And can you tell us the story? What happened to you?
I had a wonderful job, which was leading outdoor adventures for a big recreation centre in Auckland, in those days called Boys Town. It's now called Youth Town. And it was school holidays, so I took a bunch of teenagers on a trip to Tongariro National Park. In those days, the crossing wasn't known as such. It wasn't a crowded, popular walk as it is these days. It was just a place that I'd seen once in my life and thought I'd love to share that with people. And so we had a week to go away on a trip somewhere. So I had this bunch of kids, about 10, I think, teenagers, who trusted me to take them off for a very safe mountain adventure. And so we essentially aimed to walk over the crossing. We stayed one night at Mangatepopo Hut, and then I realised the weather was too bad. It was forecast to clear the next day, so I thought, well, we'll go around to the other end and we'll walk up to Kiritahi Hut, which has now been blown out by a volcanic explosion. We would walk up there, which was about a 3-hour walk up a marked track, stay there the night and see what the next day brought. As it turned out, the kids were a lot slower than I expected. It was snowing. I missed a little turn off across a creek to get to the hut. We were high up the mountain and it also got dark. So we were caught out there with sleeping bags and with a couple of ground sheets as emergency shelters. And we doubled the kids up. There was another leader helping. We doubled the kids up into sleeping bags. We squashed behind a big rock for shelter. And we all got through the night. And in the morning, it was bright and sunny. And we headed back downhill and went and got some hot soup and had a hot swim at the Tokaru hot pools. I don't think the kids had quite realised the situation we had been in. And so that's part one of the story. I don't know how much time you've got.
I was going to say in part two.
Part two was many years later, I was interviewing a man, Te Ngāhi Ehe Wanakau, who is the leader of the Ngāti Hikaro tribe, people who are the Tongariro people. And I was talking to him for his perspective on the Tongariro crossing for an article for Wilderness Magazine. And it came to be that I told him the story of us being lost on the mountain. And his response was just quite beautiful. He said, well, we'd been at the Kiritahi Hot Springs was actually the area that we'd dosed down for the night, and I suspect a lot of thermal heat coming up from there might have made us a bit warmer and helped us. His response was, the Maunga chooses and the Maunga chose you. And he gave me a big hug, and it was just so nice, as if the mountain had looked after us that night. And so we're all here to tell the story.
It sounds like Tongariro is a pretty special place for you.
It's a place I've always lived close to, nearby, and there's a lot more to Tongariro National Park than just the crossing, of course. And particularly in the summer months, I just love walking around the tussocks and the flowers, the waterfalls, the streams. There's places like Waihohonu Hut, Otoriri Hut, which is a desert-like area on the southern side of Tongariro. There's the southern side of Mount Ruapehu, where you get into from Ohakuni, with lots of beautiful old forest that hasn't been blown away by various volcanic eruptions. There's so many places to explore. It's a lovely spot.
Sean, in the introduction to the book, you talk about you write about the difference between hunting and mountaineering and tramping, because people get out into the great outdoors for all sorts of reasons, but it's not necessarily the same motivation or the same sort of thing that people are wanting to get from that.
That's right. And I think that is reflected in the type of writing you get that trampers do. I mean, hunters and mountaineers have quite a defined and clear goal. The mountaineers, their summit, and the hunters, their quarry, whether it's a deer or a goat or a tar or a chamois. So it does suit that sort of approach, climax, retreat type narrative that you might have in a travel book. And I early on thought that tramping writing didn't have that goal, and perhaps it didn't suit a good narrative. But I think I was wrong. I think that tramping does have its own narrative, but it's one of journey. It's one of going across places. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why the title Across the Pass became the title of the book. That sense of journey is very strong. But there's also lots of other things. Your companions on a trip can make or break the trip. You really test friendships on a long trip, because sometimes the environment can be challenging, sometimes annoying personal habits can be challenging. So we have a number of pieces in the book that explore those nuances of friendships and perhaps friendships breaking sometimes as well.
Yeah, just the word itself, tramping, is it's sort of a curiously New Zealand-specific word, isn't it?
You're absolutely right, Susie, and it comes out of the German word trampen, which means to walk heavily. And when Chris McLean and I were working on the tramping history, we researched the word. We have the wonderful ability now to search a whole lot of 19th century newspapers through papers past. And we clicked on the word tramping, and literally thousands of entries came up for the 19th century. But it wasn't tramping as we think of it now, walking for recreation with a pack. It was soldiers tramping through the forests of Te Uruwera in pursuit of tukuti, or it was gold prospectors prowling through the hills searching for the elusive metal, or even dancers stomping on a dance floor. So it has this connotation of to walk heavily. And I think when the tramping club started forming early in the 20th century, they decided that it was just an appropriate word for what you do here. In other parts of the world, we have a lot more amenities and facilities. If you're rambling in the English hills, you might come across a genteel pub and be able to have a nice pint at the end of the day, or even in the middle of your walk. Even in the mighty Himalaya, you'll be walking and there'll be tea houses, there'll be places where you can eat and stop for the night, and you don't need to carry anywhere near as much in those sort of environments. Whereas in New Zealand, yes, we do have a lot of huts, but you have to be self-sufficient, you have to carry everything on your back. It's a very sort of independent activity. So I think that word tramping, you know, with the connotation of being laden, suited New Zealand, and that's why we've sort of adopted it and made it our own term.
Some really interesting historical pieces here. Charles Heafy, one of them. But also, I'm intrigued by how people talked about how short women's shorts could be back in the 1920s.
Yes, that was a criticism from a tramper, actually, in the Hutt Valley Tramping Club, who and word leaked out to that reputable newspaper, the New Zealand Truth, that was always after a scandal, and they sort of blew up the story in the newspapers. And there was also some question of whether there was amorous goings on in the backcountry with mixed groups of trampers heading into the hills. And this really reflects the social times when women were a lot more restricted in what was acceptable. And tramping women pioneered social change in the 1920s and 30s by daring to wear shorts, which was considered unacceptable. So we owe them a lot of thanks for progressing things, I think.
Now, Kathy, coming back to you, because not only have you contributed the story that you were telling us earlier to the book, you also you got to have a bit of a sneak peek from Sean.
I did. I was privileged to be asked by Sean to read through all the book's entries before it went off to the publishers. There were, I think, four of us in total that did this for Sean, just picking up bits and pieces and giving our perspectives. And I'm really looking forward to reading them all again, because it was so long ago. It was last December, I think, that a lot of those stories were wonderful. I'd like to reread them.
Yeah,
Carry on.
I was just going to say, what was that process like, and what are some of the stories that have really stayed with you?
Well, some of those old heroic stories, they're in the first chapter called Footprints. They're the stories of the explorers and the surveyors, that they weren't tramping as such. They were just doing these absolutely incredible, dramatic, courageous journeys through the mountains, looking for things, sometimes guided by local Māori, sometimes not. They didn't have the fancy gear that we have these days. They got sick. I think at least one of them drowned. They're not what I relate to tramping at all, because tramping for me is wandering through the hills and having a lovely time and chatting with my companions, as Sean mentioned. But it was really nice to get all the different perspectives put together in one book, and I hope people really enjoy this read.
Yeah, Sean, if I can talk to you a little bit more about the practices of Māori explorers, that's something that the book also addresses. Tell us a little bit about that and what that was like.
Well, I think the abilities of Māori in the mountains have been vastly underestimated. They're incredibly skilled at travelling through our mountains, not with the equipment that we have today. So they had to make use of the natural materials that were available to them. And they developed incredible navigation techniques. They would have waiata and songs that would explain the landmarks across a pass, for example. They would use natural materials like tussock to make gaiters and flax to make sandals. One of the contributors in the book, Arthur P. Harper, was a well-known explorer, and his father, Leonard Harper, was the first Pākehā to travel from coast to coast over Ka Tiritiri Ōte Moana, the Southern Alps, with four Māori who guided him. And he soon abandoned his boots as being slippery and giving him blisters, and adopted the Māori flax sandals, which they would make several pairs whenever there was available material. And when one pair wore out, they would replace them with another. And he said they were not only much more comfortable, but they offered much better grip on slippery rocks. So I think Māori understood the mountains very well, understood the dangers too. They didn't have our modern down jackets or ice axes or crampons, so did avoid the mountains a lot of the time in the winter, but made some incredible journeys.
And Kathy, for you, when you were talking about Tongariro and how the Kaumātua told you that the Maunga chose you, how do you kind of look back on your connection to certain parts of New Zealand, and how has that changed and perhaps deepened over time?
Oh, I think I've learned a lot more about it. It's nature is a pretty powerful thing, and I've learned about the iwi connection with places like Tongariro, with the Maunga, And that brings a special dimension that you can just be aware of and respect. And it was very nice of Te Nehi and other iwi leaders I've spoken to, how they are so open and they share their own stories and what those places mean to them on a whole different level from what they might mean to us. And just while I've got the microphone, so to speak, I did want to make a little point reflecting on that journey on Tongariro. For trampers today, I think, have a backup plan. And that's what we didn't have that time. We could have gone to any number of other huts at lower altitudes on Tongariro and had a wonderful time. We didn't have to get caught up there in the snow on the tops. If we'd had a backup plan, a plan B. So that's my worldly advice.
Yeah, tau tōko, because you always need a plan B, C, D, E, F.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Sean, is there almost a bit of a double-edged sword sometimes with tramping? Perhaps a bit less so now since COVID has hit. But, you know, there's been so much said about the Great Walks and how you are likely to come across so many other people when you are out in the wild now. Because for so many people, it was almost the antithesis of that they were looking for. They were looking for solitude.
I think you can still find that in New Zealand. And for some people, it really is the social experience thereafter. It might be a group of friends and they book on a great walk and they meet other people in the hut and they absolutely love that. But for other people, you're right, it is the solitude that they're seeking. It's time alone in the mountains. And we're just so fortunate in New Zealand that you can have the full range of those experiences. We have over 1,000 public backcountry huts. A third of our land area is part of the conservation lands managed by the Department of Conservation for the public. We have thousands of kilometres of track, and then beyond that we have vast areas of glaciers and lakes and forests that don't have any tracks at all. So I think you can find the experience that you're after in New Zealand, and we're really fortunate.
Where are you next heading out to?
Well, I've actually just got back from 8 days in the South Island, 5 days climbing at the head of the Tasman Glacier in Aoraki Mount Cook National Park. Wonderful weather. It was hard not to get sunburnt. And then 3 days up on a pass at the head of the Huxley River, Broderick Pass, where we almost climbed another little peak and had Kia and Karara come in and check us out. Huts to ourselves. It was great.
Pretty special. What about you, Kathy? Where are you looking forward to going to next?
Well, I've got a couple of little plans afoot. So I'm heading off to not tramp, but raft the Clarence River in the first week of December. But I'm also planning on a couple of adventures into Nelson Lakes National Park to see the Travers Sabine, which are very popular, beautiful valleys that I've never really explored before. So that's something to look forward to.
Oh, it sure is. Look, thank you both very much for joining us this morning on RNZ National on 9 to Noon. Sean Barnett and Cathy Ombler there. The book is Across the Pass, a collection of New Zealand tramping writing. Like so many other books in the pandemic, it has been slightly delayed. It is expected to be on shelves in about a week or so.